For more than 2 years, Lee courageously fought his cancer with the love and support of his friends, his children, and his wife. However, October 24th, 2017, Lee died at the Aurora Hospital in Kenosha. And since we moved, I think about him every day as I drive past his house. His wife, Priscilla, was very grateful for the many friends who showed up at the funeral, those that showed they cared, those that provided support. But she was troubled, as she told me at one point, by the number of friends who did nothing more than simply send a greeting card. She said, "I saw the same sympathy cards over and over, and most people simply signed their names underneath. They had nothing about Lee, or they said nothing about Lee, or how they had remembered him." Priscilla told me, "I read the signatures and felt next to nothing." Just this last November in 2018, Sharon lost her life after a six-month battle with cancer. And her husband, Kamek, has shared with my wife via email that one cannot truly imagine what a person endures with the loss of a spouse until it happens to you. And I know we have some here that have suffered through that. Bob has been reaching out to many widows lately, and many of them comment, and he's shared with us, how they've lost their protector, their caretaker, their supporter, and their fixer. In Bob's experience, he says, men lose their wife, they lose their only true confidant, and they lose their advocate. Bob shared that many well-meaning people don't know what to say, and many people offer advice on how you should feel and or how you should deal with it. Less than 3 months ago, again in November, my friend and father-in-law died rather suddenly. And Brenda's mom, over the last 3 months, has been devastated, as you can imagine, by feelings of anger, by feelings of helplessness, by feelings of sadness, and feelings of profound loneliness. At the visitation and the funeral, I witnessed many wonderful people, wonderful friends, come up and pay their respects to my father-in-law, Butch, who did not know what to say to try to comfort his daughters and his wife. There were so many people, again, some people I loved dearly with great intentions that simply said, "Well, at least we know God's plan. And the next thing you know, Butch is going to be resurrected." Have you ever said that to somebody right after they lost a person? See, I have, and I won't say it again, ever, when I first interact with the loved ones left behind. You see, what I learned during that time is that we knew that, and my father-in-law's wife, my mother-in-law, knew that. But she didn't want to hear it at that time because she was missing her husband. You see, that's not what the loved one, again, needs to hear. They're missing the person that they may have been partnered with for many years, most of their life. What I observed, first and foremost, that helped the most were those folks who came up and gave the hug, who said, "I'm so sorry for your loss," who said, "I know you're going to miss him deeply, and please let me know what I can do." Those were the most kind words that my wife, sister-in-law, and mother-in-law felt. Brethren, in the months following the loss of a loved one, we have to understand, and many of you have been through this, loneliness sets in quickly and profoundly. And we need to understand that even if we are diligent about communicating with the survivor and that we visit them and talk to them, that although that's helpful, it's still not enough because it's not the same as missing their loved one. You can sit and visit and they'll say, "I love having you here, but it's not the same as having my husband here with me." You see, unfortunately, a lot of us, and I'm one of them, we're not so diligent about communicating with the survivors after the fact. We might give our condolences, check on them for a short while, and then we don't do a very good job of following up. And I think that's something that we all can appreciate and realize. You see, what we see from those survivors, and I've been talking to several, is they miss their person, the person they just lost. They miss their voice. They miss their touch. They miss the way they made them laugh. They miss their smell, even, sometimes. And unless you've truly experienced this kind of loss, you can't understand. We had other people that came through the line, and I've heard them say, I understand how you feel. We never understand how someone else feels. We might know how we felt if we went through something similar. But let us never say again to somebody that we know how they feel, because you really don't. We all go through things in a different way. Unless you've experienced this kind of loss, though, you can't truly understand. You understand this person can't see a clear path forward in their lives. They don't know what to do. Many times that loneliness turns to depression as reality sets in, when all of those things that the spouse always took care of now are left undone. It's up to the survivor to figure out how to deal with that. When you go to the grocery store and you don't shop the way you did before because you bought those things that your spouse liked the most, you don't truly, again, understand it. And I can't understand it, don't want to, if it means losing my spouse, right? All of those things that the dying spouse took care of are now on the survivor's shoulders. And again, they're at a loss. And it's at that point when another painful reality sets in. And again, I've heard it from several survivors that I've known. You see, the survivors still want to talk about their loved ones after they're gone. They need to talk about their loved ones. But what often happens is after a certain point, their friends and even family, they don't really want to hear it anymore. At least that's the feeling that they feel. They can tell by their body language that they've had enough of this conversation, or they'll change the subject. And I don't think sometimes that they mean to come across that way. I think it's because they're uncomfortable with having that discussion. They don't want to talk about it. Again, in some cases, people who have not dealt with it feel that the person just, you know, it's been a month, you just need to move on. Suck it up, right? Life's not fair. I hope none of us ever feel that way. There are several good messages online, and I would encourage you to listen to them. One that I really enjoyed was one by Mr. Len Martin, who, as many of you know, lost a daughter. And he knew what that was like. Excellent message. Some of the information that I'm going to share with you today came from a sermon from Mr. Tony Wasselkoff. But it's a lot of good information out there. Brethren, you see, death is a fact of life, and all of us will at some time have to deal with the loss of a close loved one, and most of us here have. When it happens to you, when it happens to me, that's when we will unfortunately realize what our friends or our family have dealt with in the past. Where will your comfort be? We can read in the Bible, we'll actually look at it. You know, Christ is talked about as being a comforter, but God the Father specifically is talked about being the ultimate comforter, and that he will comfort us in our times of loss. And we understand that we are to grow and be more Christ-like, more God-like every day, because at some point we are going to be in the God family. My question, and the title of my sermon is, when someone is in need, when they are mourning, will you be there? Simply, the title is, Will You Be There? Lynn Kane watched her husband Martin die of cancer and was devastated by feelings of rage, helplessness, sadness, and loneliness. And in her book titled Widow, she wrote that much of the well-intentioned mail she got after the death seemed like, in her words, duty writers. She said, and I quote, None of my friends meant to make me feel bad, she observed, but I don't think they wanted to comfort me either. They just wanted to get that letter written, stamped, and in the mailbox so they could move on and stop thinking about it. Something that we don't know how to do very well, brethren. I think as a group, we don't know how to comfort. And in many cases, we really don't know how to grieve. I think that's something that we need to consider. You know, to reach out to someone who's grieving isn't easy. It's complicated. What do you say? Do you want to say, I don't want to say the wrong thing to make them feel worse. I don't want to ignore them. I don't know what to do. And I think that just kind of pauses us all because we're not sure how to handle it. As observed by one particular sociologist, and she was also an anthropologist, Margaret Mead, she said this. She said, when a person is born, we celebrate. When they marry, we jubilate. But when they die, we don't know what to do and act as if nothing has happened. She goes on to say, in society, we don't know how or haven't been trained how to handle loss. You know, we're taught how to acquire things, but we're not taught how to lose them. And in the process of losing, something feels wrong or unnatural. Brethren, today what I want to do is alert all of us in this room to the critical need of facing loss, and more specifically, how can we comfort those who do experience significant loss in their life, as we all do, or have, or unfortunately will at some point in time, because it's just part of the human experience. You and I, brethren, have an obligation when others have lost something significant to reach out, not just once to offer that, hang in there, kid, you know, we're here for you, but to reach out to them and make sure that we follow up and we do our part to comfort them and to support them. Turn over, if you would. Let's get started here in the Bible, though. Let's turn at Luke chapter 15. Luke 15, we're going to see here Jesus Christ uses the experience of loss to illustrate a very important point. Luke 15, let's start in verse 3. Luke 15, verse 3, it says, so he spoke this parable to them, saying, in verse 4, what man of you, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? He's not happy that, whew, good for me, I still got 99 left. He goes and finds that lost sheep, right? Because one's missing. It's you know, absent without leave. Verse 5. And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. You've probably seen pictures or movies where the shepherd's coming back with the sheep across his shoulder, so happy that he's found it, right? Verse 6. And when he comes home, he calls his friends together and his neighbors, saying to them, rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. Drop down to verse 8. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search diligently until she finds it? Right? She's not satisfied that she's got those 9 left. She wants to find the lost one. Eventually, she recovers it, verse 9. And when she has found it, she calls her friends and neighbors together, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the piece which I lost. Now, there's some handouts. You guys want to go ahead and give the handouts out, if you would, please? It's a handout, and there's enough for every person here. And we're going to look at each side of the handout at different parts of the sermon. But the first side, as you get it, has what's referred to as the Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S, stress scale, easy for me to say, on one side. And on the other side, it has kind of the stages of grief. But if we look at this Holmes Ray life stress scale, I want to talk about what it shows. See, on this scale, it doesn't list every loss, but it lists significant losses that people can experience in life. And there are all kinds of losses on here, all kinds of stressors, right? All kinds of situations that could raise a person's blood pressure at the very least. Now, as we get those, I'll wait a minute as we get those passed out so I don't, people aren't trying to catch up. I should have passed it out earlier. Mainly what I want to look at as we look at this is look at some of the losses that we experience, not just the stressors, you know. You'll notice like number 40, if you look down number 40, One of the things that make this life stress inventory scale is major change in eating habits. That's makes this list, which means it's significant. But look at the at the rating number. It's a 15, right? That's a source of stress, if you will. A small mortgage, it says up above, is a 17. If you go up a little bit, a change in your residence or your school is 20. Trouble with your boss, beginning or the ending of school, right? Spouse starts or stops working and so on. But the major stressor, right? The most difficult of all, according to this chart, the very top, and it's awarded an index of 100, and that's the death of a partner. The death of a spouse, right? Then there's a divorce, that's the death of marriage, obviously. It's a 73. Separation is 65. Jail or incarceration, stress level of 63. Death in the family, also a stress of 63. If you drop down to number 17 there, death of a close friend is what? Rates 37 on a scale. My point is, and we won't spend a lot of time with this chart, but my point is, all losses are not the same, and even the death of all loved ones are not the same according to this. They're not all given the same value. Again, the death of a close friend is 37. The death of a family member, 63. The death of a partner, 100. It doesn't mention the death of a child. I'm sure that's very high, right, as well. It's not on here. Or the death of a parent. I know that that's very high. What my point is that we find that we experience these losses in a way that maybe we didn't expect we would. Maybe they impacted us more than we realized they might. The point of this, if you look at the bottom, and here's just a suggestion. Again, this is not foolproof for everyone, but it says in life, you want to try to reduce your stressors, the stress in your life as much as you can. According to this particular scale, it says if you accumulate more than 300 points in any one running year, that you increase the odds of 80% to coming down with a serious illness. Now, the secret is don't have anything happen to you on this page. But again, that's not the way it works, right? According to this, the key is to keep the stress between 100 and 150 or less per any 12 months. You know, there are some things we can control and we want to. Other things we just can't. But we can, with God's help, seek to manage any of these that might affect us. Again, my point for this sermon is that all loss, you know, everything it says here, they're not the same. All losses are not the same. And each one of these might affect you differently than it does me. Let's go to Job chapter 1, if you would, please. Job chapter 1. We're going to read about some of the calamities that beset a servant of God by the name of Job. Job 1, verse 1. Says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And it tells us now what kind of guy he was. It said, and that man was blameless and upright, who feared God and shunned evil. So again, we have, as described here, and I hope that someday maybe I could be described that way eventually. Hopefully all of us can. But a God-fearing man here who tried to live in accordance to God's word and God's values, his standards. And we see in verse 2 that he was blessed. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters that were born to him. And then we're told about his net worth, basically, in verse 3. It says, also, his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen. What were they worth? I don't know, but a lot, I'm sure. 500 female donkeys. Again, how much were they worth? And a very large household to look after all these animals. So this man is one of the greatest men and one of the greatest people of the East. He was blessed, okay? But we see that starting down in verse 13, trouble started happening. And one of the things we need to understand, because I had someone tell me, well, that's a really nice parable. Job isn't a parable. Job is a real life thing. It happened, right? It really happened to one person. So dropping down to verse 13, it says, now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their older brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabians railed them and took them away. Raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So things were plugging right along, and all of a sudden your servant busts in and he tells you this. And so his reaction, I'm sure if he was standing, now he's probably sitting going, what? And again, we know the story, but let's review it again. While he was speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Verse 17, and while he was speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. One after the other, after the other. Verse 18, and while he was still speaking, another also came and said, Job, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind, I envision a tornado, because that's what we understand in the Midwest, a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Again, all of these things happened in succession. In one day, they're reported. Well, how did Job react? How would you have reacted? I'm afraid my reaction might not have been the same as Job's. But let's read on in verse 20. And Job arose, and he tore his robe, and he shaved his head, because that's how grief was expressed in that day and age. And he fell to the ground, and he cursed God. He asked, why me, God? What did I do to you? That's not what he said. He worshiped the Creator God. Is that how you would have reacted? Verse 21, and he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That was his prayer. A lot of us probably memorized that. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away, from the King James Version. An amazing reaction. Verse 22, in all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. Again, and it talks about he was an amazing man, but you see, that's not the end of it, as we understand, because he had something else that he was still going to experience. And let's just go over to Job 2. You remember what happened. Job 2 and verse 7 was the loss of his health. So not only did he lose everything that he had physically, but now he's going to lose his health. Job 2 verse 7, it says, then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Now, we read through that and go, that's probably not good. But have you ever had a boil? It's not good. And to have it cover your whole body? I can't imagine the pain, how uncomfortable it was. He's covered with them. But in verse 8, it says, and he took for himself a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. So let's just pause for a minute and kind of catalog what happened to Job. What were all his losses in one day? One day. Right? First, he lost his wealth. He lost his livestock, his people that cared for them. He lost his family, all 10 of his children. Then he lost his own health. He lost his position, right? He lost his place in society at this point. And it says here that he was reduced to the ash heap of life, which is a common phrase that we use today, and this is where it comes from. Brethren, if you were in that position, how would you have handled that? It's hard to say, really. But you know your tendencies. You know your character. See, this story is here for our learning. It's here for our admonition. And it's here for our benefit. Let's contrast that a little bit and turn back to the book of Ruth. We read about Job, and we'll come back to Job in a bit. But let's look at next at Ruth. And we'll show this particular lady, you know, looking at what happened to her over a period of time. Again, for Job, it was suddenly. For Ruth, it was not so suddenly. And again, it contrasts Job's experience in a couple ways. Ruth chapter 1, verse 1. It says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons." So, again, somewhat what we see today with, you know, there's famine in the land, maybe it's like we see in Africa, people traveling to other countries. Maybe there's food and a place to live, right? But we're given that principle here. Verse 2, "The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. And the two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, and they were Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. They went to the country of Moab and remained there." Verse 3, "Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons." Now think about it. It's bad enough that she's in a foreign country, you know. Probably she knew the language, but when your husband dies, it kind of makes your situation, I would think, a little more dire. Probably had some consolation because she had two strapping sons, right, to look out for her. But, you know, the story. Drop down to verse 4. "Now they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. And they dwelt there," we're given a timeline here, "for about 10 years. Verse 5, "Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died. So the woman survived this loss of her two sons and her husband." Now, again, talk about tragedy. lose your husband and now both sons. Any one of them, either by themselves, would have been probably earth-shattering for her, but she had all of these happen. If she had this Holmes stress scale, her and Job's, you remember, would imagine how many points they racked up in a short time for the things that they went through? How does she handle it? Let's just look at two verses. And here she's, in verse 13, she's talking to her daughters-in-law. Verse 13, he said, "Would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." So she is taking this very hard, right? Emotionally, this is a very difficult thing, and understandingly so. And so we understand she then returns home to her land. And you'll recall, and we'll look at the verse in the same chapter where it tells her state of mind. Verse 21, let's drop down there. This is what she said. She says, "I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" We could have stopped in verse 20 where she said, "Call me Mara," right? She says in the previous verse, "because I'm bitter." The contrast between the two. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 5. I want to go back to the direct instructions of Christ once more. We'll look here in chapter 5 as we jump in here in the middle of the Beatitudes. Matthew 5, let's start in verse 1. "And seeing the multitudes," it says, "Jesus went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him." In verse 2, "He opened his mouth and taught them." Let's drop down to verse 4. Jesus said to his disciples here in verse 4, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, brethren, this kind of helps me make my point. We need to weigh carefully what it says here, because sooner or later, we're going to suffer that loss where we're going to need comforted. Some of us have already. All of us, to some degree, have. But there are people going through it now, and more will go through it in the future with certainty. But what it does tell us here is that when loss occurs, it's important to grieve. God says, Christ says, blessed are those who mourn. Now, there's a whole other message that we could talk about just being grieving. Some people don't know how to grieve. Some people won't give themselves permission to grieve because they have too much going on. You know, it's too busy. I'll look weak if I grieve. When we all have to, right? It's healthy. We need to grieve. It's important to mourn. But this presupposes, again, two things. Well, number one, that we know how to, because, again, many people don't know how to grieve. And number two, that even if we do, that we're not afraid to do so. We're not afraid to do so around those people who care about us. Again, it says, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Look at the other side of the handout I gave you, if you would, please. In the studies of how people deal with grief, there are numerous numbers of different publications out there that will try to suggest what a person goes through when they lose a loved one, a dear loved one. And they often will contain similar things. You know, the person has a sense of loss, then they're going to maybe go through denial, they might get angry, they're probably going to get depressed. They go through this. What they suggest, and you'll see on the left-hand side of your page, you know, kind of a structured way. This is what you're going to expect first, and then you're going to go through this and this and this. And as it does, you can see that it dips down. So as they go through the denial and the emotional outburst, the anger, the fear, that it also their well-being suffers. You know, depression sets in. They're at their lowest point at some point before they can kind of start. Possibly, and I'm using a word, using words that might not be accurate, but get their feet under them to start to live life again. The most important thing I can tell you about this is that on the right side of this sheet is what many survivors have said. This is how it goes. It doesn't go from point A to point B to point C. It goes from here to there to here to there, and I'm back and I'm all over. There is no normal way to grieve. There is no normal way to deal with it. We can't tell someone, well, you know, I understand right now you're just in shock. You're in denial, but soon you're going to feel whatever's next. You're going to be fearful, right? It's not the way it works. But I know too many people, and I think I've been one of them in the past, that have suggested that this is how you'll feel. This is what will come. Again, brethren, my point is I want us all to be better comforters, because there are people out there grieving right now, and I'm not a very good comforter, and I don't know about you, but I think we could all be better, because it's so important. In a recent survey conducted by a university in Canada, people were asked this, and Mr. Wasilkoff had alluded to this in his sermon. He said, the survey asked, how long do you think it should take for someone to get over the death of a loved one? And they had done this survey over the years different times, but the most recent answers they were given as they asked this question included, again, the question, how long should it take for someone to get over the death of a close loved one? Said, some of the answers included 24 hours, 72 hours, 48 hours, one person said, well, probably a week tops. We know we chuckle or we chuckle out of grief because we know that's not true. In fact, when a loved one dies, it takes longer than that. It takes people different amount of times, but it takes a year, 2 years, 3 years to adjust to the loss, and you never really get over it. I read and I saw this in several different places, and I asked a widow, what do you think? And she said, yes. It says, people compare this, losing your spouse, Say it's compared to losing your arm. You never get used to it, but you learn to live with it or without your arm. Think about that. Ask someone who is a widow or widower, and they'll tell you what it's like. See, when people go through loss, we have to understand when they lose someone near and dear to them, that first reaction, thankfully, is often shock. And I think that that's a blessing from God. You can ask any number of people who've experienced loss, even if they've been with that person and they've watched them suffer for a long time, and they've made the arrangements even, and they know it's just a matter of time, and hospice is called in, and they, on one hand, they think, boy, I hate to see him suffer anymore. When that person passes, even though you're anticipating it, it's still a shock because it happened. It's final. They're not here anymore. And contrast that when the policeman knocks on your door in the middle of the night and tells you that your child or whoever, your spouse has been, you know, died in a car accident. Again, obviously that reaction is shock, because you didn't know it was coming. Again, shock being the first reaction, then things come after that, the loneliness, the anger, and so on. And then a bit later, there's the guilt. If I'd only done this, if I'd only done that, if I'd only told him I loved him more, if only, whatever, if only. You know, all these things a person must go through as they go through that process of grieving. And I said before, the experience isn't linear, right? They go back and forth, and there are some steps, you know, that they may not touch on. I never experienced that. Or I kept coming back to this one over and over and over again. Again, brethren, all these things a person must go through. Remember what it said in Matthew 5, verse 4? It said, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." Mr. Wasikoff discussed three fundamental sources of comfort, and I want to share with him that he did. The first one that I want to share, if we turn over, let me get on the right page here, turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 1. As Mr. Wasikoff shared, the first fundamental source is described here in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, which, again, we understand is a very beautiful passage. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 1. It says, "Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, by the will of God, and Timothy, our brother, to the church of God which is at Corinth, with all the saints who are all in Achaia. Grace to you," chapter 2, or verse 2, I'm sorry, "grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and the God of all comfort." Again, he's talking about the God that we serve, right? The God of the universe, the great God of the universe, the Heavenly Father, is the God of all comfort. And what a beautiful description of him. And the word that's used here in the Hebrew, the word comfort, comes from the Hebrew word naam, and it means to comfort or to give forth sighs. S-I-G-H-S, you know, a sigh. You ever think about it? Sometimes you see someone sighing, and they're sighing, and it draws your attention. You think, I wonder what's going on with them. You know, as a child, I sighed, sometimes too often, and I heard about it because I was sighing for the wrong reasons, probably because I wasn't getting my way and I was unhappy. But in this particular case, we see someone sighing, and that's a body language that we need to be aware of. What's going on? Why are they sad? Why are they sighing? Verse 4, 2 Corinthians 1. We're talking about the God of all comfort, who comforts us, the great God who we serve, the great God of the universe, the God of all comfort, the Father of mercies, comforts us in all our tribulations, And why does he do that? That we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort which we ourselves are comforted by God. How reassuring it is to be able to know that we can go to God the Father in times of distress and ask him for comfort. So the first fundamental source of comfort is through prayer. To go to the great God of the universe, the Father of mercies, as it talks about, the God of all comfort, to ask him for comfort, to ask him to help us through this time of duress, this time of stress, this time of loss, as we lose a loved one. And for us, praying for that person, praying to God the Father to comfort them is something that every single one of us must be very, very diligent about. We have to go to God on their behalf. The second fundamental source that Mr. Wasilkoff talked about of comfort is found over in Romans 15. Let's turn there. Romans 15. We'll start in verse 1. Again, this passage, as we'll see, is discussing encouragement. Romans 15, verse 1. We then who are strong ought to bear with the scruples. Again, scruples here meaning weaknesses or shortcomings or failings. So we ought to bear with the scruples of the weak and not to please ourselves. Now, in the world we live in today, it appears that selfishness is at an all-time high. You know, we're told here we're not to please ourselves. Right? It says that we who are strong ought to bear the scruples of the weak. Now I would ask, but I won't, but who of you here today are strong? On the other side of the coin, who of you here today are weak? There are times when I feel stronger than other times. Personally, there are times when I feel more vulnerable. I feel weaker than at other times personally, and I'm sure you do the same. It depends on the day. It depends on the circumstance. It depends on what we're going through. There's a saying Roy Rogers used to make. It says, we are all ignorant, but only on different subjects. Kind of applies to the same thing, right? We're all strong in different areas. We're all weak depending on the situation and in our own circumstance, right? It comes, it goes. It's not the same. Going on here in Romans 15, verse 2, it says, let each of us please our neighbor for his good, leading to edification. Again, leading to building up, not tearing down. Verse 3, for even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me. Verse 4, for whatsoever things were written before were written for our learning, that through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures we might have hope. So the second point for our fundamental source of comfort here is described here as we read in verse 15, and it talks about, again, encouragement. Many of us probably have scriptures that we like to turn to. When we're down, you know, there are some scriptures that we turn to time and again that gives us some encouragement. And if you have a list, which I suppose many of you do, you probably, the book of Psalms is on there somewhere. Because we can read those Psalms, we can read about all those things that David went through, all those terrible things that he endured, some of them he brought on himself, we understand that. But all of the time that he was buoyed down in duress and distress, and how he endured and how he handled that. That's encouraging. So again, source number two for our comfort is the Bible. It's the encouraging words that we read here in particular. Mr. Wasilkoff went on to say then that the third fundamental source of comfort, again, is found back in 2 Corinthians. Let's turn there, 2 Corinthians chapter 7. 2 Corinthians 7, verse 4. Great is my boldness of speech towards you, great is my boasting on your behalf. I am filled with comfort. That struck me as interesting. When was the last time you said that? When was the last time you said, I'm just replete with comfort. I'm full of it. I'm oozing comfort, right? But he wrote this. He says, I'm exceedingly joyful in all our tribulation. Verse 5, for indeed, when we came to Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were troubled on every side. Outside were conflicts, inside were fears. Nevertheless, in verse 6, nevertheless, God, who comforts the downcast, comforted us by the coming of Titus. And not only by his coming, but also by the consolation, now that's another synonym for comfort, with which he told us of your earnest desire, your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced even more. Drop down to verse 13. Therefore, it says, we have been comforted in your comfort, and we rejoiced exceedingly more for the joy of Titus, because his spirit has been refreshed by you all. So what is this third source of fundamental comfort? It's you. It's us. It's the brethren, right? It's our fellow man. It's our friends, right? It's our neighbors, our associates, our colleagues, the people that we know well. But the top of that list is us. We have to know how to do this, brethren. People we relate to and, you know, people that have the same faith. It's important for all of us to have a network of people that we can turn to, that we can count on, that will be there when we need them. And don't just send us a card with our name signed in it, right? We need to be able to do more. There's a letter Mr. Wasselkopf included in his sermon. I want to read it to you because I like it. It was from Ann Landers that he found. I said, a few months ago, you reprinted a letter, and I would like to promote that letter, the writer said. The letter says, on May 11th, my lovely 25-year-old daughter, Patty, was killed in a car accident. On the Monday after her death, I went to her office to clean out her desk, and while I was there, several of her coworkers came by to express their sympathy. The letter goes on to say, it says, all conversations ended like this, if there's anything that I can do. Well, a thought came to me that I would like to share with your readers. I told each of these sympathetic coworkers that there was something that they could do. I asked them to write down their thoughts about my daughter and mail them to me. I told them that I didn't care whether those thoughts were about Patty, what she did, or even how they felt about her, or even some event they had shared. I asked them to write down anything and send it to me. I told them that receiving the notes would give me a piece of Patty back to me. It would provide a glimpse of her life that I didn't even know about as her mother. The responses I received have been heartwarming. To date, I've received 30 letters from coworkers and friends, and when I begin to feel blue, I read those letters over and over, and I'm comforted. Please suggest it to your readers who are grieving. No words can express how much those letters have meant to me. It goes a long way. At my father-in-law's funeral, we asked a longtime friend and an elder in the church to conduct the service for us. As my brother-in-law, who was also a local elder, we both didn't think that we were up to conducting the service. But at that service, we did things a bit differently. Started out with the elder read, I call him Butch, that's my father-in-law, they read his obituary. When he got done, he introduced me. I decided that, looking back on how smart it was, that I would go up and I would tell the people what I wanted to say about my father-in-law. You see, what had happened before I got up is all of the family and we were a fairly small, close family, the two daughters, us son-in-laws, the grandchildren, and my mother-in-law decided that we're going to write out what we wanted to say to our father-in-law, what we missed most about him, and what we looked forward to. And so we wrote it all out, and they were incredibly touching. And again, I decided I would write mine, but I wanted to get up and speak it. And it proved to be a little more difficult than I thought. But as I was up there reading, I could look out at the audience and see that they were also very moved. After I sat down, the local elder then took all of the letters that were written by the rest of my family, and he read them one at a time. It wasn't your typical funeral service. We found out later many people liked it, even though I don't know if there was a dry eye in the place. But it meant a lot to us to hear again stories about Butch and things we may not have known, you know, some of the pranks that he pulled on me as a son-in-law that I cherished forever because we were at each other all the time just doing stuff. But we kept those, and when things get rough, you know, I know my mother-in-law, she likes reading those over and over again. She wants to hear stories about Butch. She wants people to talk about him. She wants people to remember him. You see, it's what we wanted, and it helped us who are mourning. Let's go back, if you will, to the book of Job. We talk about mourning. Job went through some terrible things. We understand. But Job had some, we'll call them special friends. They were special in some ways and special in others. But in time of his severe duress, they responded. Job, just go back to chapter 2, and we'll start reading in verse 11. We won't go through all of what they talked about here, but we'll hit the high points. Job 2, verse 11. So it says here, "Now when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him." So they were making an effort. Those were their two objectives, right? To mourn with him and to comfort him. Both, again, vitally important. Verse 12. "When they raised their eyes from afar, they didn't recognize him. They lift their voices and they wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven." And then verse 13, "So they sat down with him on the ground for 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great." Now, if we would have just stopped reading in chapter 1, we would have thought, well, Job must have handled all of this, must have finally took it in stride and kept on going. But we see that he didn't. Right? It was very, very difficult for him because the word I can only think of is catastrophic. What he dealt with was catastrophic. And so his friends, we see, they compared notes, they made arrangements, plans to come together to reach him, to give him the consolation that you would hope only friends can. And for 7 days, they sat with him and they said nothing. He looked at them, they looked at him, he looked at them, they looked at him, right? He cried, they cried, who knows? But we see that as long as they said nothing, they were being helpful. The trouble begins when they started giving him some advice, and it was, as we could read, we won't, I encourage you to do that, it was misdirected advice. But drop down to Job 21, verse 1. Job finally had listened to all this, and he finally had said, okay. He answered and said, "Listen carefully to my speech, and let this be your consolation. Bear with me that I may speak, and after I have spoken, keep mocking." And we'll skip on down to verse 14. He says, "How then can you comfort me with empty words, since falsehood remains in your answers?" So again, they were doing really, really well as long as they kept their mouth shut. But when they finally thought Job had had enough, like, come on, Job, it's time to get going here, buddy. You've spent enough time mourning the loss. That's when they started shooting themselves in the foot, if you will. In Mr. Wasselkopf's sermon, he mentioned a pamphlet that he picked up a few years ago. And it was the pamphlet, and I had a chance to look it up, and it's very good. It's called A Friend Is There, Suggestions for the Friends of the Bereaved. And one of the things that he pointed out, and I will share with you, and you'll see it in any number of books on the topic, is that it's very important that we, as those who are comforting, avoid platitudes or avoid cliches, you know, things like, you're doing so well, or hang in there, others have been through this and they survived. Some of the other things that are common is, I know just how you feel, which we talked about already. You don't know how they feel. Or be strong. You'll get over it. Time will take care of everything. Or some people say, think about how blessed you are. It could have been worse. Those words come out of our mouths as we're trying to help. And we're not trying to beat the person up or make them feel worse, but think about it. Just as bad, and one thing that I need to get much better on, we just get busy. And we assume the survivors are going to be fine. We have well intentions. Oh, I should send them an email. And we get busy. Or I should send them a letter. I should stop in. We have great intentions, but we never follow through. That person starts to feel even more and more alone as time goes by. And there may be situations where we might actually have a feeling, at least to a degree, how they might be feeling because you've experienced a similar loss. But again, it's every person that's individual. Can't assume we know what they're going to. The booklet ends up saying the most important thing that we can do is to be genuine, but to avoid cliches and platitudes. Turn over to Job chapter 42. Job chapter 42. Let's start looking about what happened toward the end of the book of Job. Again, time had passed. Job had improved tremendously. And his circumstances had gotten better significantly. Job 42, verse 9. It says, so Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did as the Lord commanded them, for the Lord had accepted Job. In verse 10, and the Lord restored Job's losses when he prayed for his friends, saying, get out, instead of saying, get out, you bums. I don't ever want to see you again. You have not been a help. You made this worse. Job, a man of God, he prayed for his friends, it says. Indeed, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Verse 11, then all his brothers and all his sisters and all those who had been his acquaintances before came to him and ate food with him in his house. And they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversity that the Lord had brought upon him. Each one gave him a piece of silver and each a ring of gold. So even, again, we're talking about some time has passed. After his situation had improved significantly, they didn't cut him off again. He was still visited. He was still visited regularly. He was still consoled. He was still comforted. Because, again, we need that for a long time. We just don't get over things that quickly. In verse 12, now the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 sand camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys. And in verse 13, he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. So we can see, brethren, again, what we've been talking about is that consolation, comforting, it needs to happen for a long time. It just can't stop soon. Well, another thing that they mentioned from the booklet Mr. Wasselkoff had talked about called A Friend Is There that I want to bring to your attention, just a few subheadings, and I'll share those with you. Some things like that we should do, reminders to us, basically. It says, one of them is, it's okay to cry with them, even laugh. It says, don't be afraid to touch the person with their permission. It also says, send the person a letter. Maybe make a contribution. Remember the holidays. Remember their birthdays. Remember their anniversaries. But above all, continue to call and visit. He went on to say, you could ask your bereaved friends, can I help? Do you need anything? But not wanting to intrude or be a burden, they're going to say, No, I'm good. I'm fine. Even when their refrigerator might be empty. Or the only times that they go to town is to go to work because they have to. The suggestion and the overall advice that this booklet gave is simply this: don't ask, do. In other words, we'll say, is there anything I can do? Well, just don't offer that. We actually need to do something. We need to drop by with some food. We need to call them. We need to make appointments to take them out. You know, take the children, if there's children, take them out for an exciting, a fun excursion. Invite the family into your home. Don't just let them sit there alone. Don't ask, just do, that booklet says. Let's look at a couple more scriptures as we start to wrap up here. Turn back to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Let's read start in verse 14. It says, "For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep." That is, again, we understand those who had died. Verse 16, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first." So here, when we say to the person with well-meaning that, you know, don't worry, he's going to be resurrected again. We know that's the truth. The survivors know that's the truth, right? But we see it here. This is very comforting for all of us. You know, there might be some advantages in this case, right? The person who died first gets to be resurrected first. They get to become a spirit being first. We get all that. But again, it's not what we talk about right away when that person is dealing with their loss. Verse 17, "Then we who are alive, who are not yet deceased, and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord." I could see my father-in-law saying then, "What took you so long?" You know? And I can't wait to see him then. Verse 18, "Therefore comfort one another with these words." If you go back up verse 13, it says, we might have talked about that. It says, "Don't grieve as those who have no hope," right? We are to grieve, but we are to grieve as those who have hope. Probably the most important thing I could say, brethren, is that you and I have an incredible obligation to be comforters for those who are mourning in their time of loss. Drop on down here to chapter 5, verse 11. It tells us again this. It says, "Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you are also doing." Again, you and I are told to comfort one another, to remember one another. And that means not just going to the funeral if work will allow, but it means following up with that person, making sure they're okay, right? When they say, "No, I don't need anything," don't bowl your way into their life, but read between the lines, look at their body language, understand that their loss is overwhelming. You know, we are told to remember one another. All those lessons that we learned from the school of hard knocks that we're living, called this human life, we need to understand that all of us are going to deal with these things in a different way. And still God says, he tells us, "I am the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob." He says, "I'm not the God of the dead. I am the God of the living," which means that in his eyes, all of his servants are as good as alive at the second trumpet. And we look forward to that. But in the meantime, I ask every single one of you in this room, the next time that you see a brethren, a close friend, a family member, whoever, the next time you see one of these people mourning a severe loss, will you be there?